Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
This is part two of the Psych Pearls interview with Dr. James Knoll. Please check the show notes for a link to part one.
How did you get interested in treating patients in corrections and also treating this small percentage of patients who are very difficult to treat and very hard to treat, morally objectionable ones?
Sure. Well, I'll take a step back. And as you mentioned in the outset, I'm James Knoll IV. James Knoll III was also a psychiatrist. So growing up, you see, my fate was written. I had little choice in the matter. In all seriousness, I was exposed to the importance of mental health from a very young age. I did have a kind of a pinnacle experience when I was young, about 10 years old. I came home and my parents, at the time, they had these things called magazines that they used to deliver to your house and people would read them. It was amazing. And we had a copy of Time magazine on the coffee table. And on the cover of it was this big vat of cyanide. And it was an expose on the Jonestown, 1978, the Jonestown mass murder-suicide. My 10-year-old brain could not wrap itself around this when I first saw this. And I thought and thought long and hard about it. And the next day, our homeroom teacher asked us to write a book report or a one-page report on anything we wanted to. And so the next day, most kids had written a report on their family pet or their favorite baseball star. I had written a report on that I was a Jonestown member who had managed to survive by faking my own death and pretending to be dead. Now, whether there was a concerned parent-teacher conference after this was called, I don't know. I wasn't involved. I wasn't invited. But this was surely a sign that a red flag that I was going to be a forensic psychiatrist.
Right.
A lot of my family is in medicine, but I also had family in law enforcement and in the legal profession. And I think this was sort of my compromise at being able to kind of blend the two interests.
I mean, it's remarkable. It sounds like a true vocation, a true calling. I mean, as you say, it blends so many parts of your interests and your background together. That being said, for you or other doctors working in forensic psychiatry, and especially with those truly difficult patients, do doctors usually burn out?
It is a risk, Paul. It's definitely a risk and one that one needs to be aware and conscious of to prevent it.
Do you find yourself taking some of these things home with you? Or are you able to leave some of the horrible stories you hear just at the office?
You know, it would be disingenuous if I told you I didn't take things home with me. Of course I do. I think over time, I don't want to hold myself out as a shining example, but over time and making a lot of mistakes, I've learned ways that help me personally to avoid burnout.
Oh, would you mind sharing with those of us? Because I'm sure everyone in our audience would like to hear it too. You have a high degree of difficulty. What do you do to, you know, stay mentally and physically well?
I have this conversation, by the way, I'm a forensic psychiatry fellowship training director. So I make sure to have this conversation up front and often with my trainees. One thing I would say is I tell them that it's very important to have at least one or two things in your life that you pursue purely out of interest and passion, not out of need or necessity or being on the clock or, you know, it's, you know, your job or your work. Very often I've found that you can put these things under the umbrella of art, what I'm going to call art. So what I've found is all things related to art and creativity help me and my colleagues who've told me, help them avoid burnout and try to stay in the zone of some type of well-being. And I think the reason for that, you know, art and creativity is these are things that don't have an end. They carry meaning and potentially joy. And so I think, you know, you really have to inoculate and titrate yourself with things like that. It's a must.
Absolutely. I mean, I can imagine anything from painting to woodworking to working on old cars being a way of doing something that doesn't have an immediate clinical payoff, but frees you to make a difference in the clinic.
Yes, we have wonderful discussions about that sometimes with my fellows, and they'll tell me about the most fascinating hobbies they have. And I think it's just so important to have those things in your life, you know, so that you can kind of take the blinders off and, you know, mm-hmm. achieve some kind of balance.
And looking forward now, we've talked about the past. Now let's talk about the future. You know, where do you hope forensic psychiatry will be in 10 to 20 years, both for the general population and for that little sliver of morally objectionable patients?
Yes, great question. Well, you know, I would tell you, I'll give you a little insight into, there's a little bit of a tension right now in forensic psychiatry. Not all tension is bad. Some tension is healthy. But the tension, I think, is between what is our identity, particularly here in the United States. It's interesting to me, in the UK, forensic psychiatry, when people invoke that term, first thing people think about is treatment of offenders or justice-involved individuals. Here in America, since we're also wonderfully narcissistic, me included, we think of expert witness. Forensic psychiatrist means expert witness and testifying on the stand. I suspect and hope that we maintain that healthy tension, but we begin to give a little more attention to forensic treatment efforts and issues. I will also say that I think this is going to happen anyway, but technology is ever progressing. And so much of our profession and forensic analysis is going to involve technology, social media, et cetera. We have to embrace it. We don't have a choice. And so I'm going to be fascinated to watch this unfold and the different ways that it unfolds.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, how is it working now and how do you hope it'll work in the future?
Yes. It seems not that long ago when you would have a forensic case, you'd get very excited because the attorneys would send you a box of records, a physical box of records. And I've been through stages where it's material records, then they'll send you the CDs, then they sent you the thumb drive. Now it's just in the cloud. And it's the same thing with analysis of cases. I'm not just analyzing victim statements, witness statements, or police reports. I'm actually looking at real-time texts from an offender right up to the time of the offense. And so my hope is that it's going to give us more clarity and objectivity.
As we conclude our time together, in the interest of emphasizing clinical treatment, if you could share one important tip or piece of advice with your colleagues about clinical treatment, what would it be?
You know, I think to go back, circle back to where we started with that narrow, small group of treating the morally objectionable, I think because of my upbringing and early indoctrination from my family and my father, I always had the attitude that I'm there in a special capacity. I'm not there to judge. Even if I did judge, so what? What difference is it going to make? How is that going to move the ball down the field or change things from a treatment perspective? I'm there in a special capacity, depending on what hat I'm wearing. If it's a treatment clinical hat, then that my job is to first do no harm and relieve suffering. And judging, I think, makes things worse, makes mental well-being worse. There's a certain amount of this, though, that you can't stop. It's going to happen in your head anyway. Just recognize that, let it go, and then go home and focus on your mental well-being.
Yeah, I think that's great advice because I'm sure doctors of every kind, if they don't deal with your kind of morally objectionable patients, they're still going to deal with patients who are grumpy.
They do.
Who are making maybe choices that the doctors don't agree with, or they're non-compliant. And the message, hey, stand back, don't judge, treat, I think is a good one.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. But Dr. Noel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been my pleasure and honor.